Leck had barely been included in any of the planning. Indeed, he had been so busy with his work at the Kremlin that he had never even been to the Winter Palace, much less the Grand Church, any time during their long engagement. So when he and his parents arrived from the airport on that snow-covered yet sunny Saturday morning, in a heavily guarded motorcade about an hour before the ceremony began, Alec found himself overwhelmed by the stunning locale. The Winter Palace, Alec knew, was once the official residence of the Tsars. The green and white structure on the banks of the river Neva in St. Petersburg was long and low, rectangular and mammoth, with more than 1,000 rooms and more than 100 staircases. The cathedral, known as the Grand Church, was located on the east side of the palace grounds and was spectacularly ornate, with its massive onion dome, gilded and gleaming in the sunshine, so rare at this time of year. Inside, the main sanctuary was more beautiful than anything Alec had ever seen before. The white marble walls and columns were trimmed with gold. The high ceilings were adorned with gold sculptures. The chandeliers and lamps were made of pure gold, enormous gold statues of angels, each bearing wings, some holding trumpets, were mounted on the walls. Pews accommodating 1,000 guests had been set up in the long hall before an altar under a soaring dome. Light streamed down onto the altar through stained glass windows, and mounted on the wall above was a gold statue of the Christ hanging on a cross, surrounded by golden angels. Despite the beauty, Alec shuddered at all the iconography. Neither he nor Marina was religious. It all seemed so antiquated and banal. If it had been up to him, he would have whisked his fiancée off to Monaco for a quick civil wedding and a honeymoon among the glistening beaches of the Mediterranean and the high-rolling casinos of Monte Carlo. Unfortunately, as had been made clear to him time and time again, it was not up to him. So here he was, ready to participate in a spectacle designed to showcase the glory of Russia to the world. Alec excused himself from his parents and stepped into a back room to have a cigarette and change clothes. When he came out, he was not only in full regimental dress. He was wearing the exact uniform in which Nicholas II had been married, as his father-in-law-to-be had insisted. Alec had initially chafed at the idea, but Alexander Luganov was not a man to whom one said no. Alec's mother dabbed away tears with her handkerchief as her son stood there in the hall, wearing the tall black leather riding boots, black trousers with a single gold stripe running down the outside of each leg, a bright red tunic adorned with gold, gold epaulets, and a sword in a beautifully designed scabbard attached to a thick leather belt. "It's time," said the Russian Orthodox Archbishop, stepping out of a side chamber. The cleric, the highest-ranking bishop in the Russian Orthodox Church, was stooped and graying. He wore a bulbous, bejeweled mitre adorned with icons of Jesus Christ and two other figures Alec couldn't identify, a liturgical gown that reached to the floor, and a golden cape festooned with crosses and other Orthodox icons. In his right hand, he held an enormous golden staff topped with a cross. He led them down a long, dark corridor, and then through a door that opened onto the grand hall. An aide to the archbishop directed Alec's parents to their seats as the organist began to play, and Alec's heart began to race. Had the ceremony, both the first portion known as the betrothal, and the second portion, known as the crowning, not been broadcast live to the world in its entirety and videoed, so that the young couple could savor it later, Alec would have been hard-pressed to remember much of it. So overwhelmed was he by all the guests, the Klieg lights, the heavy aroma of incense, and his own dizzying emotions. The bishop's words, the scriptures that were read, the long passages of the liturgy, and the communion service after the vows, all went by in a blur. Alec could not remember the names or faces of any of the dozens of heads of state and ambassadors and scores of Russian oligarchs and their trophy wives who attended. What he would never forget, however, was the sight of the president leading his daughter down the aisle, and a look of immense pride mixed with a father's tenderness when he put Marina's hand in Alec's. Even more, Alec would always remember how stunningly beautiful his bride looked in the flowing white and gold silk dress and diamond-studded crown, the very one worn by Tsarina Alexandra in 1894. He would remember the flicker of firelight dancing in her eyes, as each of them held a single golden candlestick during the ceremony. And he would remember the moment her soft and supple lips parted, and she affirmed her love and loyalty to him until their dying breath. Afterward, the wedding party and all the guests moved into an exquisitely appointed stateroom, housing the original wooden dining table used by the Tsars to entertain European guests back in the day. It could, and did, seat exactly 1,000 guests, and featured original china settings used by the Romanovs. The president and first lady sat at the head of the table. The newlyweds sat to their right, Alec's parents to their left. Alec cared little for the gourmet menu, or the wide variety of vodka and wine that was served, or any of the toasts or the dancing. He hated all the eyes staring at him, all the cameras flashing, and the bright lights of the TV crews. He just wanted it to be over, so he could sweep away his bride and enjoy their honeymoon in peace and quiet, alone and far from the hoopla. His impatient daydreams were interrupted, however, when Luganov leaned over and whispered to him at one point during the reception. Having just lit up a Cuban cigar for himself and offered one to Alec, the president had pulled his son-in-law close to him and kissed him on both cheeks.
"Alec Stefanovich, I would not have given my Marina to just any young man. I trust you, my son, and see great potential in you. I know you will give me many grandchildren and raise them to be princes and princesses, loyal and brave. And I want you to know that if there is anything you need, you have only to ask."
The man looked deep into Alec's eyes.
"We are family now," the president added. "Come what may, we must stick together for the glory of Russia, for the glory of our dynasty."
23. Monument, Colorado, December 30th, 2004. Marcus Ranker's wedding to his high school sweetheart was hardly a spectacle. It was a miracle. And Marcus had the Taliban to thank. Elena Garcia had seen the story of the helicopter crashes and the shootout in Kandahar on the evening news. When the story about Marcus being wounded in combat appeared in the local media a few days later, Elena broke up with her new boyfriend, a medical student at UC Denver, and called Marcus on every number she had for him. When she couldn't reach him, she called his mother. Then she called her father. By the time Marcus was awarded the Purple Heart, he and Elena were a couple again. And after he'd recovered and been given a brief leave for Christmas, they were married. The ceremony in which Marcus Johannes Ranker pledged his undying love to the eldest daughter of Javier Rodriguez Garcia was so small and understated, it didn't even get reported in the local newspapers. The Garcia family had money, but Elena begged her father not to use any of it on a big wedding. She didn't want all the fuss, nor did she want to do anything that might cause embarrassment to her mother-in-law-to-be. Marjorie Riker was now a widow twice over. Surviving on Social Security and a modest Air Force pension, she was barely making ends meet, especially given all she'd done to help Marcus through college. Marcus didn't want anything showy either. The incident in Afghanistan had already brought him far too much attention. Something simple and quiet sounded just right to him. So Marcus's mother hosted the two families for dinner at her home on a snowy Wednesday evening. She made lamb chops, mashed potatoes, green peas, and mint jelly, Marcus's favorite. The next afternoon, the couple were married in the Garcia's living room. The pastor, who had discipled Marcus during his senior year of college, officiated. Only immediate family and a few close friends attended. The reception was catered by famous Dave's Barbecue. Afterward, Marcus and Elena drove to Aspen for a honeymoon of skiing and snowboarding, a wedding gift from her parents. Friday was New Year's Eve. With a massive snow squall bearing down on everything west of the Continental Divide, Marcus heated up the leftover Chinese food they'd had for lunch. He opened a bottle of champagne that had been chilling in the small refrigerator, compliments of the resort. Glad their Baptist friends were, for the moment, nowhere to be found. Then they curled up by the fire in their rented two-level villa, and Elena gave her groom not one gift, but two. Marcus tore the wrapping paper off the first, and what he found took his breath away. It was a single-volume first edition of Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago, and it was signed by the author himself. Marcus gasped. "This must have cost you a fortune." "You're worth every penny," she replied, her eyes dancing with desire. "I would have paid 10 times more." They kissed with abandon, until Marcus realized he had not opened the second gift. They took a pause, caught their breath, and sipped more champagne. Next, Marcus unwrapped the somewhat larger gift. "What's this?" he asked. "You'll see," she said playfully. What he found was a scrapbook Elena had made for him. On the first page was a faded class photo of Marcus in the 6th grade. He stared at it. Elena laughed. Marcus did not. He looked hideous. His hair was long, his clothes were too dorky to describe, and he was wearing braces and battling acne. He was not smiling. Instead, he looked forlorn, and Marcus knew why. All those memories started rushing back, and he fought to control his emotions. He didn't want to ruin the moment or make Elena feel bad. But the photo was taken not long after he had lost his father. He thanked her and was about to kiss her, but Elena nodded to the note she had written under the picture. June 2nd, 1991, Photo Day, Lewis Palmer Middle School. "This was the day I fell in love with you, Marcus Riker. This exact day. My family had just moved to Monument from the Springs. I had cried for weeks. I pleaded with my father not to make me change schools so close to the end of the year, but he didn't listen. He'd found a house he and Mama liked, so we moved, and there I was. My sisters weren't born yet. I was lonely, depressed, angry, furious, and yet suddenly curious about this cute boy in English, social studies, and P.E. The only reason I came to school every day was to see you. You were taller than the rest of the boys. You were quiet, but strong, and fast. Fast like the wind. And crazy. Always climbing on things, jumping off things, doing backflips, pulling pranks. You were always getting in trouble, but not real trouble, not big trouble. The teachers liked you. You always seemed to get off with a warning. You were just having fun, and you were fun to be around. I had only one friend, Marcy Gallagher. She sat in front of me in homeroom.
Her dad was the mayor. She knew you. She liked you. She would talk about you all the time. So I never told her about the crush I had on you. Then came the day for class pictures. My mother sent me to school that day in the ugliest brown dress I had ever seen. She had just bought it for me the night before. She insisted I wear it. I screamed at her and told her she was ruining my life. I threatened to sue her for child abuse, but she wouldn't relent. She sent me to school in that hideous dress, on photo day of all days. Somehow, when I got in line to get my picture taken, lo and behold, I found myself standing right behind you. I was so mortified. I kept praying you wouldn't turn around and look at me. But you did. That was the day you introduced yourself to me. You asked if I was new to the school. I was so scared I couldn't speak. So I just nodded and blushed. And you smiled at me. Not a big smile, just a little smile. But it was such a sweet smile. And you told me you liked my dress. When the photographer said it was your turn to have your picture taken, you sat down, and your smile faded. All at once, you looked sad. I wondered why. I wanted to ask you, but you said goodbye and ran off to class. The photographer called my name. I just stood there, transported into a dream world where Marcus Riker had actually talked to me. To me. Smiled at me. Complimented me. You were either a big fat liar or a very kind boy. I decided it was the latter. And I told God, right then and there, that I wanted to marry you. I told God I didn't know why you were sad, but I wanted to make you the happiest boy in the world. And then I ran off in that hideous brown dress, without ever having my sixth grade picture taken. My parents were furious, but they got over it. And I got you. So, just in case you didn't already know it, that's my mission in life. Marcus Johannes Riker, making you happy for the rest of your life. You can't shake me now. I'm yours forever. Marcus held his wife tightly. You can't shake me either, he whispered in the candlelight. I'm going to stick to you like glue.
Part 4 24. Colorado Springs, June 18th, 2006. Marcus Riker tore south on I-25, but this time he was not a man possessed. Someone was going to be born tonight, and he'd never been so excited. With Elena in the back seat of their Ford Expedition, groaning in pain and pleading with him to be careful, Marcus abruptly flashed back to the night his mother had been in such danger, the night he'd driven like a maniac to come to her aid. He was still a risk-taker, but he'd learned a few lessons along the way. He was older now, wiser, he hoped, more focused, more experienced, and more careful. He wasn't going to do anything to put his wife and child in danger, not now, not ever. That said, he was going 90 miles an hour as he blew past the exit for the Air Force Academy on his right, then the focus on the family campus on his left. Before long, he was getting off on Highway 87, zigzagging through a series of side streets, pulling into the parking lot at Memorial Hospital, and racing toward the emergency room entrance. Elena was just shy of 42 weeks. She was, therefore, almost 2 weeks late. She had been experiencing intensifying labor pains for much of the last 2 weeks, yet showed no signs of dilating. She was scheduled to be induced in 3 more days, but just after 10 p.m., her water had finally broken. It was now 10:27. Elena's contractions were coming harder and faster. Marcus screeched to a halt, jumped out, and carried his wife inside, abandoning the expedition
and tossing the keys to a security guard inside the door. Elena's OBGYN met them in the lobby, accompanied by two nurses. They helped Elena into a wheelchair and whisked her off to labor and delivery, Marcus following close behind. Once there, a team of medical professionals immediately surrounded her. But Marcus wasn't about to be boxed out. He moved to her side, took her hand, and watched the blood drain from his own as Elena gasped and cried out and squeezed with all her might. For the next 2 hours, Marcus coached her along. He reminded her to breathe deeply. He dabbed the sweat off her face with a cloth. He offered her ice chips and fought not to comment on just how powerful her grip could be with this much adrenaline coursing through her body. All the while, he silently thanked the Lord for his timing. Only weeks before, he'd finished his 4-year contract with the Marines and raced back from Baghdad to be at Elena's side. Eventually, however, it became clear that a serious problem was developing. As Marcus watched a bank of monitors digitally displaying the latest second-to-second data from mother and baby, he could see what the doctor and every nurse in the room could see. With every contraction, the baby's heart rate was beginning to drop precipitously. Initially, between contractions, the baby's heart rate had settled at between 140 and 150 beats per minute. But now, during the peak of the contractions, it was plunging. The first time Marcus noticed it, the heart rate had dipped to 83. The next time, it dropped to 76. Then 72. Then 64. Then just 61. Worse, when each contraction was over, the baby's heart was not returning to normal. Rather, it was returning to barely over 100. And now the OBGYN informed her team that she was concerned the baby was going into fetal distress. She ordered them to prep for an emergency C-section. "No!" Elena cried out when she heard that. Then she dissolved into tears. Her body was trembling. Her lips were starting to turn blue. Marcus thought he'd seen everything. He'd been in combat. He'd seen friends die. He himself had been shot and nearly burned alive in the wastelands of Kandahar. He thought he'd become impervious to fear. But seeing his wife in such pain, and seeing their baby experiencing such trauma, was almost more than this Marine could bear. "Doc, she wants a natural delivery," Marcus said, his voice nearly faltering mid-sentence. "I know," said the OBGYN, "but the baby can't take much more." The doctor checked the monitors again. The baby's heart rate was just 95. "Mrs. Riker, I'm going to ask you to push again," she said. "You're doing great. You're doing everything I'm asking. And I want to give you the chance to try again. But if your baby's heart rate drops too far, I'm going to do what we call a crash C-section. But don't worry. I can have the baby out in 30 seconds. Everything's going to be okay." Elena said nothing. She couldn't. Tears were streaming down her face, but she was doing everything she could not to make a sound. Marcus knew why. She wanted to be strong. She didn't want him to see her falling apart. But her hands were clammy. Her body was getting weaker. The whole thing was taking a terrible toll on both mother and baby. And Marcus was fighting back his own emotions. His bottom lip quivered. His eyes were moist. He was scared. Not for Elena. She was tough. She'd be fine. He was terrified that the baby, his little daughter or son, they still didn't know which, might not pull through. "Okay, Mrs. Riker, take a deep breath and push one more time," the doctor said. Elena squeezed Marcus's hand and did as she was told. Immediately, the baby's heart rate began to drop again. 90, then 80, then 70, then 60. When it dropped under 60, the doctor made the call. Marcus was pushed away from the table, and the team went to work. He couldn't see everything that was going on, and it was all happening so fast. But he heard a gurgling sound as the scalpel plunged into his wife's belly. He saw blood gushing from her, blood mixed with amniotic fluid. It was spraying everywhere. His hand immediately went to his mouth, covered though it was by the surgical mask. He felt lightheaded. Tears poured from his eyes, though he dared not make a sound. He took several steps back, then felt the reassuring touch of a nurse's hand on his arm. He'd seen more blood than this. On that mountainside in Afghanistan and in that cave. But he'd never seen it flowing out of his wife. He hadn't prepared himself for this. Neither of them had. They'd never seriously considered a cesarean might really be necessary. That was foolish, of course. He'd been trained to not only consider, but plan for every eventuality. But he hadn't. And now he regretted it. Elena had been given general anesthesia, so she was out cold. And for this he was grateful. Because the baby, covered in blood and mucus, was not crying. Was not making a sound of any kind. Everything in him braced for the worst. This baby was dead. He was sure of it now. Elena was giving birth to a stillborn child. He was watching it happen with his own eyes. And when Elena awoke, he would have to be the one to tell her. He didn't know if he could. But suddenly, he saw the legs begin to flutter. Then heard a cry, and then wailing. No sound had ever seemed so precious. 25.
It's a boy!
Marcus shouted as he rushed into the waiting room. Marjorie Riker burst into tears and flung her arms around him.
I don't believe it, she said as she held him tight. I'm so proud of you.
Congratulations, Grandma, he said. How long have you waited to hear that?
Too long, she cried. Is he healthy?
Healthy and beautiful, and I can't wait for you to meet him.
Me either,
she said, laughing through her tears. Then finally let him go after a moment, and fished some tissues out of her purse.
You should call your sisters, she said as she dabbed her eyes. They'll be tickled pink.
Blue, Marcus corrected.
What?
It's a boy, Mom. They'll be tickled blue. She laughed again, and the elevator dinged. When the doors opened, Mr. and Mrs. Garcia and Elena's sisters, now teenagers, rushed out, flowers in hand. Mrs. Riker couldn't contain herself, blurting out the news before Marcus could, and the whole family squealed with delight.
Congratulations, Marcus said to the girls. Today you are both aunts.
They oohed and aahed, and he answered their questions and gave them all the details he could think of, only omitting for now any mention of fetal distress and the touch-and-go moments. Mr. Garcia beamed as he shook Marcus's hand vigorously.
You're going to make an excellent father, Marcus, he said in that elegant and distinctive Spanish accent. You just need to get a job that's safer than the Marines.
I'll do my best, sir.
Sorry, son. If Kandahar was your best, you're going to have to do a lot better.
They laughed together as Elena's OBGYN approached.
Mr. Riker?
Yes?
Your wife is out of surgery now.
She did fine.
Everything went very well. The C-section was picture-perfect, no complications.
Marcus breathed a sigh of relief.
She's in recovery. She's awake, a bit groggy still, but awake. And she's asking for you. Can I take you to her?
Yes, please, he said. He turned to make sure everyone else was okay. They told him they were, especially with this reassuring news, and urged him to go and give Elena their love. They would see her soon enough. The doctor led Marcus through a set of secure doors and down several hallways until they reached the recovery room. Marcus poked his head between the curtains. Elena was holding their baby. And when she saw Marcus, her eyes lit up.
Hey, madre,
he said with a smile, coming over to her side and giving her a kiss on the forehead.
Hey, padre.
She smiled back. How are you feeling?
Tired, but good.
Pain?
Not yet.
Keep those drugs coming.
Amen.
Your folks are outside, and your sisters, he said.
That's fun. And your mom?
Right there with them. I just gave them a briefing. They all send their love. I can't wait to see you. Marcus leaned down and looked into his son's eyes. Milk chocolate brown, like Elena's. Pretty cute, huh? He said.
Adorable, just like his father.
I don't know, Marcus said. He looks a lot like your side.
True. I was just trying to be nice,
Elena teased, punching him playfully in the arm.
So, what are we going to call him?
I don't know. You don't like any of the names on my list.
That's because all of your names are ridiculous, she teased. Zadok?
Really? Zadok is a great name, he protested. Right out of the Bible. He was a priest for crying out loud.
It's never going to happen.
They went through several other names, rejecting each for various reasons.
What if we name him after your father?
Elena said after a long pause.
Lars?
He asked.
Yeah, she said. He's always been your hero. It's a great name. Strong, masculine, Dutch. And it certainly goes with Riker.
He smiled again. He loved this girl, and never ceased to be amazed by her. What if we give him your father's name, too? He asked.
Lars Javier Riker? She asked.
In a country of 300 million people, I seriously doubt there's another one like it. They kissed to seal the deal. But there was more to discuss.
So, listen, Marcus said, easing into the pool. I've been giving this a lot of thought, and I've decided not to re-up.
What? Elena asked.
I thought you wanted to be an NCO.
I did. But this changes everything.
But the Marines love you, and you love being a Marine.
What about your father?
Once you became a hero, he seems to have made his peace with it.
Still, I don't want to be an absentee dad. I want to get a little house with a white picket fence and a big backyard where Lars can play. Here, on the front range, if God lets us. I want to teach him to ride a bike and throw a football, and go fishing and hiking and whitewater rafting. And I can't do that in the Marines. Not the way I want.
So, what would you do? She asked.
I think I could find a decent job of some kind in law enforcement. And if not here, then somewhere farther out west.
How does San Diego sound?
Lovely. What about Seattle?
Rainy, but great coffee.
Exactly. Or Santa Fe or Salt Lake City.
Any place that starts with an S,
she quipped. Anywhere we can be together, he replied. Deal?
Deal,
she said with a smile and another kiss.
You can't shake me, Riker.
And I don't want to, Riker. I'll stick to you like glue. 26. Moscow, July 2nd, 2008. After two bitter miscarriages, Marina delivered their first child. It was a healthy baby boy, and Alec was ecstatic, as were the rest of his and Marina's extended families. Yet no one was more pleased than his father-in-law, who promptly insisted that the Archbishop of the Russian Orthodox Church himself, the one who had originally married the young couple, come to the hospital and pray for the baby and his parents. Luganov further insisted the bishop also perform the dedication, in the tradition of the church. The ceremony would be performed on the 8th day. This was also the day the baby would be named. In the times of the Tsars, before the Communist Revolution of 1917, it was tradition that the local priest, not the parents, would name the baby. This is precisely what Luganov wanted. Privately, Alec strenuously protested to Marina. His heart was set on naming his firstborn son after his own father, Stefan Mikhailovich Kraskin. But Marina pleaded with Alec
to let her father have his way.
I love you more than life itself, Alex Stefanovich. You know I do,
she said, as the two headed to their bedroom and undressed for the night.
But my father is not nearly the patriarch of my family. He is, by all rights, the patriarch of Mother Russia, and thus our shepherd, guiding us as a family and as a nation down the path he knows is best. Everyone is watching us, because everyone is watching him. Please, my love, do not deny my father the honor of following tradition or the right to uphold the heritage of our people.
But they are not our traditions,
Alec pushed back, rooting through every drawer for a cigarette, but finding none.
We are not religious people. This is nonsense. We'd be doing it just for show.
That's not true, darling,
Marina argued.
We may not believe in God, but certainly we believe in honoring our parents, do we not? Even more, we believe in upholding the glory of Mother Russia.
Of course, but then I beg of you,
Marina interjected.
Let us not concern ourselves with these myths and legends. They are not important to us. I don't even think my mother cares. Your parents certainly aren't pious, but my father is.
Pious?
Alec asked, his voice tinged with cynicism.
Well, religious,
Marina replied.
The point is, this matters to him. So why not give him this gift? This very simple but precious gift.
The name of our child? The very name he will bear for eternity?
Eternity? Why must you be so melodramatic, Alex Stefanovich?
Marina said.
In the grand scheme of things, this is so trifling a gift for so great a leader, no?
No, that's just it. It's an enormous gift for a man who already has everything,
Alec shot back, increasingly desperate for a smoke.
Marina, my darling, we finally have a son of our own, an heir, someone to carry on our name and our values. This baby is everything to us, especially after losing two others. Should we not be free to name him as we wish?
Love is a stubborn thing. In the end, Alec relented to his beloved wife, if not her father. Not only would he allow the bishop to name their son, but he also agreed to ask Marina's parents, not his own, to be the child's godparents. Thus it was that on the eighth day after his birth, their baby was dedicated by the patriarch at the Church of the 12 Apostles on the grounds of the Kremlin. The bishop gave him the name Vasily. Neither Alec nor Marina could remember a branch in either family tree bearing anyone with this name. But Alec knew exactly where the name had come from. It was the Slavic version of the name Basil, which came from the Greek name Basileus, meaning king. There had been at least four or five Russian czars and princes named Vasily. The name hadn't come from the archbishop at all. It had come from the president himself. On the 40th day after their baby's birth, Alec and Marina met again with their two families, not inside the Kremlin's walls, but in St. Basil's Cathedral, the iconic onion-domed church planted in the heart of Red Square. The occasion was the baptism of little Vasily Olegovich Kraskin. Once again, the president had chosen the venue. He had insisted that the archbishop and several priests be in attendance, along with every member of his cabinet and dozens of other VIPs. As with his daughter's marriage, Luganov wanted a national spectacle. The press was there, and the brief ceremony was the lead on the evening news. This time, Alec did not resist, even in private. This was important to Marina, because it was important to her father. He was willing to swallow his pride and go along. But he remained deeply uncomfortable with the religious commitments he was being asked to make in front of the entire country. As the service began,
and incense wafted through the darkened sanctuary. Alec stood beside the altar. He held a single lit candle in his hand. At his side, Marina, wearing a traditional headscarf, held their crying baby in her arms, as the bishop, wizened and gray, led them through the liturgy.
Alek Stefanovich, do you renounce Satan and all his angels, and all his works, and all his services, and all his pride?
I do, Alek said. I renounce Satan and all his angels, and all his works, and all his services, and all his pride.
Marina was asked the same, and she responded in kind.
Alek Stefanovich, do you unite yourself to Christ?
The bishop asked. Alek took a deep breath.
I do, he said through gritted teeth. I unite myself to Christ.
Marina answered in the same manner. Then came more prayers, more incense, readings from scripture and from various Orthodox prayer books Alek had never heard of. Eventually, after nearly an hour, though it seemed much longer, the bishop took their baby, held him over a large silver urn, and poured a silver pot of lukewarm water over his head. Vasily did not cry, but Alek nearly did. Alek was surprised by how emotional he felt as a final prayer was said, and Marina wrapped their son in a towel and held him to her breast. Marina was crying. So were Alec's parents, even as they beamed with pride. Oddly, Yulia Luganova neither cried nor smiled. Indeed, she showed little emotion at all. The president, however, seemed genuinely and deeply touched, especially when Marina turned and put her son in her father's arms. For only the second time Alek could recall, the first being at their wedding, the hardness in his father-in-law's fierce and forbidding features visibly softened. His eyes were red and moist. He struck Alek as uncharacteristically vulnerable, even a bit self-conscious in that vulnerability. In that moment, he was not the sovereign ruler of a great people. He was a simple grandfather who now held the grandson he had so long desired. Alek stood in the great and shadowy cathedral, the flickering light of candles and the intoxicating aroma of incense enveloping him, and pondered a thought that he had never dared consider before. Was there now, perhaps, a pathway to the kind of relationship with his father-in-law Alek had always longed for? Were the cold steel barriers between him and this man he both feared and admired finally coming down? 9 days later, Russian forces invaded the Republic of Georgia. Alek never saw it coming. He was not even in Moscow at the time. Rather, he had been sent to Beijing as part of the official Russian delegation to observe the opening ceremonies of the Summer Olympic Games. He learned the news the same way every other world leader at the Games did. First from the BBC, and then via every other news service on the planet. 350 Russian tanks, hundreds of armored personnel carriers, and more than 9,000 ground forces, including elite Spetsnaz units, were blasting their way into South Ossetia. Under cover from Russian fighter bombers and heavy artillery fire, they were taking the main roads in South Ossetia and pushing toward Georgia proper. Another 30,000 Russian troops were massing in Abkhazia, the Russian territory directly adjoining the Georgian Republic, and a sizable Russian armada was streaming across the Black Sea, headed for Georgia's western coast. Alek was not simply stunned. He felt betrayed. While he had participated in meetings where snap military exercises in Abkhazia had been discussed at length, he hadn't been in a single meeting or on a single call, or seen a single document or email, or cable, in which an invasion had been even hinted at, or alluded to, much less stated outright. Aside from the feeling of utter embarrassment at being so far from home, and having to represent and defend his nation and his president, among dozens upon dozens of world leaders who were condemning the invasion in no uncertain terms, a flood of painful questions rushed through Alec's thoughts. Why had the president invaded Georgia? Why would he invade any former Soviet republic? Was he really intent on capturing and occupying the entire nation, even Tbilisi, the capital? What in the world for? What was the upside? Wouldn't this seriously damage Russia's reputation, not to mention harm her economy in volatile and uncertain times? And why hadn't the president trusted Alec enough to let him in on the secret? 27. Kubinka Air Base, Moscow, March 15, 2009. President Luganov's motorcade roared up the tarmac at precisely 9 a.m. Stepping out of his armor-plated limousine, the Russian leader walked briskly past the honor guard standing at attention on both sides of the red carpet, with Special Agent Pavel Kovalyov, chief of the president's security detail, close behind him. There was no crowd to cheer, no members of the press or any cameras to smile for. This trip was not on his official schedule. Indeed, only a handful of people on the planet knew it was going to happen. Luganov bounded up the metal stairs and entered the presidential aircraft, a wide-body, specially outfitted four-engine Ilyushin Il-96 jet, and took his seat in the back. Defense Minister Mikhail Petrovsky followed the president onto the plane, as did Dmitry Nimkov, the head of the FSB, and Boris Zakharov, the president's chief of staff, along with a phalanx of bodyguards and several military aides. Last, and for the first time since joining the presidential staff, Alek Kraskin boarded the plane. He worked hard to maintain a professional demeanor, but the truth was Alek was terribly excited to have been asked to join the delegation, though not nearly as excited as Marina was for her husband to be taking another step deeper into her father's confidence. Since Luganov's decision to invade Georgia and occupy no less than 20% of that former Soviet republic, and since Alek's decision not to simply defend, but to fully and even aggressively support the president in each and every tense conversation with leaders in Beijing, Alek's relationship with his father-in-law had deepened considerably. Word of his fierce and vocal loyalty had gotten back to Luganov, and had been both noticed and appreciated. Though Luganov never said a word to him, Alek could see that his duties and responsibilities were steadily expanding, and he was certain it could all be traced back to the summer of 2008. Increasingly, he was being asked not merely to take notes of the most confidential of meetings the president had in the Kremlin and elsewhere in Moscow. He was also given recordings of all the president's phone calls with members of the Duma and various world leaders, and instructed to produce official transcriptions. In fact, in recent months, the chief of staff had invited him to actually be on most of these calls live, taking notes in real time. He was included in all senior staff meetings. He was given various follow-up assignments of increasing complexity and sensitivity, and he had even begun traveling with the president on most trips within the Russian provinces. But until now, Alek had never been included on any official state trips. Instead, two colonels from the defense ministry typically rotated in the role of private secretary when Luganov traveled abroad or to meet with foreign heads of state. Alek certainly had been given a tremendous window into the thinking and the actions of Luganov and those in his inner circle, and for this he was grateful. But he secretly yearned for more. While he often reminded himself that 142 million other Russians would give their right arm to have his job, the truth was, He wanted to travel abroad with the president. He wanted to counsel and advise him, to be a participant in history, not simply the recorder of it. He privately resented being treated somewhat like a child, being seen but not heard. Back at his law firm, he had been a partner, the youngest in the firm's history. He'd been an active member of the team, looked to for his opinions and insights in addition to his loyalty and hard work. This had not been the case since coming to work at the Kremlin. But now, without explanation, the president had personally asked Alek to accompany him on a mysterious trip to meet with an as-yet-unidentified world leader, and neither of the colonels were anywhere in sight. Alek marveled at the luxurious interior of the presidential aircraft, codenamed Command Point, as he took his assigned seat just behind the president, buckled up, and prepared for takeoff. The dozen oversized seats located in the center of the plane were all upholstered in white leather with the seal of the Russian president embossed in gold on each headrest. There was also a white leather couch that seated four. In the rear of the plane were a conference room and the galley, from which stewards prepared everything from snacks to hors d'oeuvres to gourmet meals and served vodka and wine, as well as soft drinks, coffee, and chai. Toward the front of the cabin, adjacent to the cockpit, was a bedroom for the president, a medical bay, and a communication center providing secure voice and data links to anywhere in the world. 10 minutes later, the Ilyushin was airborne. The moment they reached a cruising altitude of 36,000 feet, the seatbelt light went off, and Luganov asked Petrovsky, Nimkov, and Zakharov to join him in the conference room. Alek, still not briefed on exactly where they were going, gazed out the window at the clouds and the sunshine, just glad to be on board at all.
"Come, Alek Stefanovich, what are you waiting for? Bring your notebook."
Alek looked up at his father-in-law, and then at the other aides, who appeared nearly as surprised as he was. Alek was being summoned into the inner sanctum, and he was as thrilled as he was stunned. Once the door was shut behind them, Luganov took his seat at the head of the conference table, impassive and inscrutable. Alek went to sit at the far end, but the president told him to sit next to Zakharov instead. Alek complied. As he opened a fresh notebook and took a pen from his breast pocket, he noticed that Luganov was dressed in a dark blue business suit, a crisp white shirt, and a navy blue silk tie with small white polka dots. It was a small detail, but he remembered that this was precisely what his father-in-law had been wearing the day they had first met, the day Alek had asked for his daughter's hand in marriage. It quickly became apparent where they were heading: Vladivostok, site of Russia's largest naval base, located on the Sea of Japan, at the extreme southeastern corner of the Russian Empire. Defense Minister Petrovsky explained that he had ordered his staff to arrange the trip on the premise that he would be conducting a surprise inspection of the submarine fleet that constituted the bulk of Russia's ability to project power into the Pacific. Petrovsky would, in fact, do just that, accompanied by Zakharov. But the real purpose of the trip was something entirely different. Once in Vladivostok, the president, FSB Chief Nimkov, and Alek would be driven to a secret military facility where they would have dinner with the reclusive leader of North Korea, who would be arriving by train.
"Why by train?" Luganov asked. "He is petrified of flying, Your Excellency."
"How far is that journey?"
"Almost 500 miles.
Alek stopped writing for a moment and looked at Petrovsky. 500 miles by train? He wondered, though he said nothing. This North Korean really is insane. That turned out to be an understatement. Nimkov reminded Luganov that the man had several titles he would appreciate being used when they met. He wanted to be referred to as the ever-victorious, iron-willed commander, He also wanted a reference made to the glorious general who descended from heaven. While he was partial to highest incarnation of the revolutionary comradely love, he would not be offended if Luganov preferred to simply call him the guiding star of the 21st century. Alec could have written a book about the absolutely bizarre eccentricities of the North Korean dictator he observed during the two-hour meeting between the two leaders, from what he wore, to what he ate, to how he expressed himself. But what truly disturbed Alec was how close Luganov seemed to be to this madman. Alec had never participated in, much less created a transcript of, a single call between the two leaders. Yet the evidence suggested the two men had spoken dozens of times over the past few years. They clearly had a history together, and they were using a personal shorthand to build their framework for an entirely new bilateral relationship. At first, none of it computed. On the plane, Petrovsky had advised Luganov on ways to persuade the North Koreans to end their nuclear weapons program and enter into a new round of six-party peace talks with South Korea, China, Japan, Russia, and the United States. Luganov had acted as if he fully agreed with his defense minister. But once Petrovsky left the room, it became obvious that defusing the North Korean threat was not Luganov's objective at all. As Alec took notes during the meeting between the two heads of state, it was clear that Luganov was trying to clandestinely flip Pyongyang's allegiance from Beijing to Moscow. In so doing, he seemed willing to help Pyongyang become a regional powerhouse, ready and able to intimidate and even dominate Seoul, Tokyo, Taipei, and everyone else in the Pacific Rim. To accomplish this, Luganov offered to cancel North Korea's $11 billion debt to Russia and provide some $2 billion in new Russian grain shipments. That's why, Luganov said, he'd persuaded five oligarchs to be prepared to invest upward of $25 billion in developing North Korean natural resources like coal and iron ore over the next decade. That was also why Luganov was offering Moscow's technical assistance with helping Pyongyang build ballistic missiles, capable not only of carrying nuclear warheads, but of reaching the continental United States. Luganov's chilling offers were immediately accepted. But there was more to the conspiracy the two leaders were concocting. They agreed that to throw the West, as well as Beijing, off the scent, Russia would publicly and forcefully condemn Pyongyang's ongoing nuclear weapons tests. They even wrote the press release together. What's more, they agreed that Russia's foreign ministry would actively support additional economic sanctions against North Korea at the UN Security Council meeting later that month. It would all be a show. The guiding star couldn't have made himself more clear that he eagerly sought to be the Pacific arm of a rising new Russian empire. He agreed to fully share the results of North Korea's ICBM testing with scientists from Tehran in order to help the Islamic Republic of Iran become the Middle Eastern arm of the new Russian empire. Then, in the final minutes of their time together, the two men lowered their voices and somewhat cryptically agreed to be helpful to each other on additional projects of mutual concern. Alec wasn't sure what they meant, nor was he certain he wanted to know. But he dutifully wrote down every word he heard through the official translator and kept his mouth shut. 28. The flight back to Moscow was surreal. Luganov lied to the defense minister's face. He spoke of the sober but successful talks he'd had with the guiding star. He said he believed new Russian financial assistance to Pyongyang was going to help curb the lunatic's nuclear ambitions and bring North Korea back to the six-party peace talks. He insisted Russia should pursue a policy of both carrots and sticks. They would surprise the world by